So thanks for sticking around. Thanks to Guy for putting together a great program and being our energetic moderator in between sessions and getting us all riled up again. We're here today, this panel is here today to talk about smart strategies for audience engagement and viewership. And we've got an esteemed panel of subject matter experts here. We'll talk a little bit about data strategy, about recommendation and personalization, and about the consumer perspective on all of this. And so if you'd all like to introduce yourselves with a quick blurb.
Kyle Hufford, Director of Digital Asset Management. I work at an energy drink company. You guys all might know of it. My passion is photography, and I almost went to Clown College when I was 16.
You went what?
Clown College.
Oh. I think your mustache is cool. I'm Lori H. Schwartz. I'm principal at StoryTech, and I'm also governor for the Interactive Media Peer Group at the Television Academy. And I really focus on that swirl between media, tech, and content, and just keeping everybody up to date and educated and curating information so that business can grow.
Hi, I'm Chad Ludwig. I head up brand marketing at Fandango. Been there for about 3 years. Prior to that was at Disney and a few other spots in town. More recently, I focused more on kind of our B2B solutions with our studio partners largely, and launching a product called Fandango 360, which is leveraging a lot of our data to propel campaigns on the studio side.
All right, so we'll get started talking a little bit about data strategy, because we all know there's lots of data out there. Sometimes there's too much data out there, and data strategy is getting a lot of press these days. Data strategy can mean different things to different people. So what does it mean? Maybe Kyle, do you want to start?
So I think a key thing, we've been going through a lot of test cases of like AI and data, and one of the things that we've realized is sometimes even though you can capture the data, it doesn't mean that the data is important to the business. So a lot of times we've had to filter through data, or we've had to get rid of data and realize that only data from maybe like an AI perspective, we're working on a proof of concept right now to actually be tagging images and get better at understanding how we can identify our athletes and the people in those images. And we've realized that like 60 to 70% of the machine generated content is just rubbish and we're never gonna look for it. So really understanding what are the core pieces that people are gonna look for and what are the things that the audience wants. So instead of figuring out what metadata or values to add because me as a librarian wants to see it, but understanding what the consumer is looking for and understanding what the reports the business needs.
So a little bit of beginning with the end in mind. And that's always a good strategy. Do either one of you have something to add there?
No, I mean, I think that's right. I would just say that, you know, for me, and the work that we do, we're really focused on the outcome, right? Working backwards from that outcome. And in entertainment, that's a hard place to start from, right? Because most of the outcomes, you don't have an interaction with, right? So you're going through a retailer, you're going through an exhibitor. And so I think it's challenging, but if you can focus on, I'm trying to sell a ticket, I'm trying to sell EST or VOD, we'll set SVOD services off to the side for a second. Starting from that validation point and then working backwards to figure out what information influences that decision, to Kyle's point, helps to narrow the scope of the things you're looking at, because we're awash in data.
I was going to say, from the paranoid side of things, I know a lot of my clients are worried about what people think they're doing with their data strategy, and so they don't want the public to know that they're actually looking at as much as they are. And so how they go to market with their data strategy is a big issue right now.
Yeah, there's a big balance there, and we'll talk about that in a minute. So taking a look at this and knowing that we're starting to put together data strategies and beginning with the end in mind and outcome-based orientation, strategy traditionally has been 6 months, a year, 18 months, 5 years, 10 years into the future. How far do each of you look into the future when you're considering strategy?
I come from a very performance-oriented mindset, and so I don't think right now. I mean, certainly you can lay a planned spend or a planned allocation, and most of my focus on every day and on this panel will be around kind of marketing plans and how do you generate activity in the marketplace that then gets you a sale. You know, I was looking at numbers before I came in on campaigns that we're running right now for this weekend, and giving all the stuff that's going on in the world, we're making active decisions of what to spin up, what to turn off. So I think as far as your data strategy, I think you certainly have to look at it long term, but be really nimble and pivoting to things that you didn't think were going to matter. Now, all of a sudden, you're looking at earlier signals than you had before because of things in the marketplace that may change the actual outcome.
You know, most of my clients and colleagues talk in the 3 to 5 year range, but I would say that most are looking daily at everything. I mean, everything changes right away. Like, look what's going on today, you know. I mean, I didn't shake your hand, did I?
I think we're all doing the elbow bump today, right?
I think from a timing perspective, it's really important to have a roadmap of where you want to be. But some of the challenges are, in my organization, is that we're a really, really big little company. So there's a lot of things of decisions that people made like 10 years ago or 5 years ago or 7 years ago that we're now having to fix. So we have to look at it every 30 days or every 60 days and look at small projects that we can get us along that mile road. Because sometimes that data strategy is connecting an ERP tool with a content syndication tool, which nobody thought was possible before. And now we're in a world where these systems are now talking to one another to push our content out so that I can now have consistent images across all e-commerce platforms, where before I could never do that as a brand.
Yeah, and that makes a lot of sense. I think that kind of the visual that I tend to think in pictures a lot, and the visual that I get as the three of you are talking is we've got this data strategy, and it's huge and it's overreaching, but it's being evaluated on almost a daily or, you know, hourly basis so that you can make course corrections early and still get to the end goal if it's selling a theater ticket or, better yet, getting somebody endeared to a brand or a character so that they will follow it through the franchise or through the life cycle of a title. And I just closed my questions because I forgot I was a moderator. So let's jump a little bit into kind of how do you decide what to market? How do you recommend what to market? And there's different ways of looking at that. There's, you know, consumer-based, where you and I have similar tastes in food, and so therefore we'll like similar taste in content, which may or may not be true. Or there's the metadata approach, where you take all the metadata for a particular piece of content and see how closely that matches with something else. Do you have an opinion on which way to attack it, or is it kind of all-encompassing?
Well, we've, in the past year and a half, been working really hard at Fandango to take all the different consumer interaction points and look at that and build out predictive models on propensity, right? So Carter was talking earlier about, you know, people staying in their lanes in terms of their content affinity. And I agree with that. I think that there's nuance, right? So you might come up in romantic comedy, but you might have an even greater affinity to an actor who has starred in several romantic comedy movies that you've watched. And so that actor may deviate and move into a drama or something else, and that as a consumer may draw you out. And so what we're trying to do is look at all of those interactions against that metadata as a consumer on an individual basis and saying, this person, yeah, they have an affinity for drama, or romantic comedies, but it goes much deeper than that. And we score kind of all of our users across those different interactions, and we can help our studio partners to delineate who to go after and why to go after them. Is it because of that IP? Is it because of that actor? Is it time of year? All of those different components come into play. And then encouraging them to try that and any other thing that they want to try, and optimize for whatever is going to deliver the best outcome.
And Lori, what do you think about that from your clients or your consumers' perspective? You know, there's a lot of stuff being thrown at audiences today.
Yeah.
Everything's saying, watch me.
Yeah, well, there's two things I think. I think brands and marketers are so used to dealing in demographics, but what's happening now is this layer of technographics, so that I might actually be having the same behavior as my grandmother, because we're both into using our tablet, you know. And so all of a sudden now we're having to look at that data in a different way. And so the data monkeys now are informing traditional researchers who are sitting on years and years and years of data about who they thought their segment was. But now we have this whole new thing happening. And then there's all the social media inputs that are changing how we see things too, which is, we were talking about this before, but I don't know how many of you have been asked by your colleagues or friends, and there's sort of some social pressure to tell them what are the top 10 shows you're watching, or what are you watching on Netflix right now, you know, or whatever it is, right? And then it becomes a status opportunity, and then if people like your show, you know, you get some, you know, what I would call in Yiddish, yikes. You get some
street cred.
Yeah, you get street cred for you know, having shows that people actually liked. And so all of a sudden now there's this whole new thing going on of, I have a free hour tonight, you know, give me the show that I am going to love, you know. And so that's a whole different metric and direction point. Input. What does your mustache think of that?
Well, I mean, I'm not as consumer-facing, meaning somebody watching a show, right? Our consumers are actually internal customers. And so for us, marketing is like trying to get the sales operations person to realize that we have System A and System B connected, and they need to stop downloading content and emailing it, right? And so the biggest challenge, I think, from our perspective is really change management of behavior from an employee perspective and an employer perspective, and also the colleague perspective. And it kind of aligns to that, you know, sort of like street cred, but then you have all of these, because we're this really, really big little company, everybody loves working in silos. I have my own solution. I have my own, you know, somebody said shadow IT today. I mean, that's my biggest fear right now, is like I have to go around and find all of the marketing systems that somebody set up that's not connected to our single sign-on. So I have no idea whether or not, you know, beyond the data and the marketing of this and how we're going to market to people, like just securing our content, which is a big piece for us.
I can imagine. And I understand your company, we didn't talk about this earlier, but I understand your company also does some live events, some sporting events, extreme sports, and potentially concerts and things. So does that come into play at all when you're looking at data strategy?
I cannot directly speak to that. I'm on the system side of it. So, but I can tell you from a licensing and a like contracting standpoint, it's a really big deal, because we are a beverage company. We're not an event company. So all of those events, if you look at like Supercross or Monster Trucks, all of those are put on by event companies that do that. And we hire them to do that because that's their expertise. And same with music. We have a music licensing company. We don't own a public performance license. So all of these things that we do, our main focus is to sell you another can of an energy drink. That's our goal.
I like the sugar-free blue one of your brand. Anyone else want to jump
I was on? Just going to say one other quick thing. I think in terms of audience engagement, and a lot of our studio partners, you know, one of the first jobs that I've ever had where I pretty unanimously get the answer to the question of who's your audience. Oh, it's four quad. It's four quad, young, old, male, female. It's everybody. And I would love that to be true. It's not. And so one of the things that I think is part of the data strategy as well is understanding who is not your audience. So then you can focus on who is. And there's a ton of things, like horror films is a great example. There are a lot of people that just don't see horror films. And so excluding them, even if you took kind of your attitudinal consumer research and said, we think it's going to be, you know, adults 35 to 54 that have this kind of other interest segment, just from an attitudinal respect, and then exclude from them people that don't like that movie, right? That can exponentially increase the audiences, the efficacy of the audiences that you're speaking to, because they'll respond to it versus just saying it's four quad for everything.
And then there's always the people that are going to watch a horror film no matter what it is.
Absolutely.
Or who it's from, and so you don't have to necessarily do as much outreach to them as you would the ones that are in the middle or the ones that are on the fence.
Yeah.
So that's really interesting, and that's still getting back to the consumer side, I think.
Yeah, I was going to also add that there's the other side of this too, where you're watching something at home, generating some data, but you go to jump in to watch it in another room on a different platform, and it doesn't work as well. So that becomes an input that is not really relevant to the previous input. But, you know, because I have like a, you know, a Fire Cube TV in one room, but then I have an Apple in the other room, and one is an older Apple, so I can't get Disney Plus, and I have to remember which room works, you know. And so all of a sudden, I'm factoring in all sorts of other inputs, and I can't end that piece of data that you were looking at correctly. Do you know what I mean? So there's a lot happening right now in the home that is, I think, really altering the inputs that we're talking about, you know?
I agree. And, you know, whether you have a smart TV or a smart speaker or a tablet, mobile phone, what have you, switching from platform to platform sometimes is seamless. but other times it's more frustrating, and you definitely lose the story and the enjoyment of the story, but you also can lose the context and your sense of relaxation. But I want to go back to something you just said about you sit down to watch a show and you're going to generate some data. So I think next time I come home and the family's just sitting around watching TV and I think they should have been doing something else, I'll just remember they're generating data for our industry, right. So I won't be quite so mad about it.
Well, the thing is that everything we do is generating data, right? And I have also a bunch of...
I'm generating data right now.
That's right. And in front of all of you, too. I talk to a lot of my mom friends who are not in this business, and they are terrified that people are watching them, spying on them, listening to them, watching them. And so they curb their behavior because they don't want to give data away. So there's that piece too, you know.
Yeah, that's the piece that borders on creepy. And I think it's, you know, different levels of creepy in different people's minds, but that's definitely something to be concerned about. Yeah. And so then let's take it back just a little bit and talk about the B2B work that you're doing and kind of how the differences are between a recommendation engine for a consumer that's doing, you know, web browsing and things like that versus a recommendation engine for a studio or another content owner that might want to use your services.
Yeah, I mean, I think ultimately from a consumer standpoint, we'll get to a better place on predicting what content when they land on the page is going to be most compelling. I think we're still a ways off from that for us specifically, and I think the industry at large is still trying to work through that depending on what your business model is, right? If you're an SVOD service, you're going to favor your own originals, right? Because that's an exclusive component. You want people engaging in that content because that's a retention mechanic. If you're in the TVOD space, you want to most likely feature the latest and greatest release, because that's where the vast majority of your transaction comes from. But going back to what I was saying earlier, I think both from a marketing standpoint and a user experience standpoint, we can be better. One example is if you went to a movie last weekend, 99.9% of people are not going to go to a movie the next weekend, right? So also thinking about the different product categories that might be viable for you as a consumer. So I think we're not only helping to try and delineate between, you know, who is the right audience for your product and why, but at what point, right? And if you think about, we're actually doing a bunch of work on theatrical behavior patterns, home entertainment behavior patterns, and what we were talking about earlier with Carter's presentation, things are changing. And so, you know, we're looking at, and we don't always know why, But in mass, there are good sources of non-PII aggregated data that can give you better answers as to why, and then what you can do with them. So if you look at like Movies Anywhere is a good example of continuity across multiple retailers in the TVOD space. So if you're watching on a Fire Stick in one room and you go into the other room and you're on Fandango Now on Roku, and you're using the same library, that continuity is available to see and understand that you stopped in one room and you finished it in the other room, right? So all that to say is I think most of the work that we've done to date, we've looked at all these different various consumer interaction points, transaction, browsing. We own Rotten Tomatoes as part of the Fandango Network, so we're able to see that as well. And that has done a ton on the theatrical side. We're seeing significant lifts in ticket sales using that data versus other data, and I think that, you know, we'll likely expand that to other franchises.
Very, very good viewpoints. Anything to add? All right, then we'll move on to the next question. So I think, you know, one of the things that we all have to face that nobody really wants to talk about is that four-letter acronym CCPA. We know we're protecting consumers. We know we're in California, and so the laws here are a bit more strict, and we're leading the way in consumer protection. So how has that and other regulations really impacted strategy around collecting and using data? And before we do that, one of the quotes, Chad, that I think you came up with on our prep call was, you know, what do we do in a cookie-less world? And so I just have a question for the audience. How many of you have iPhones? How many of you have ever asked Siri what's 0 divided by 0? All right, so don't do it right now because it'll, you know, disrupt the panel, but on the break, ask Siri what's 0 divided by 0 because it is really funny and relevant to this conversation. So what does this all look like in a cookie-less world?
So, I mean, I'm just going to say what's on my mind, and the reality is Cambridge Analytica. And the reality is looking at the reason why GDPR is and why CCPA is. Somebody took something that was our data and engineered a way through Facebook to ask a couple of questions to change the way the outcome of our US presidency happened. And people think it's a conspiracy theory and all this other nonsense, but the reality is that this is beyond consumer protection. This is actually protecting way more than that. And the reality is as these data points come out, and if we have been willing to give our data away for so long, because if you think about it, in the 70s and 80s, the big thing was like, oh my gosh, the government's looking at me, they're spying on me, they're listening to my phone calls. And the challenge that we have now is, yes, the consumers are protected, and yes, the consumers can delete their data. But the amount of delete requests that Google's gotten is like minimal in comparison to the ones that people who have actually said, okay, cool, at least I know that I can delete my data now. At least I know that as a consumer, I can do that. And me as a consumer, I think that's great. But now, how do we manage that from the business perspective, right? All of our website properties, we had to go through a whole GDPR thing, you know, 2 years ago with a whole European thing. CCPA is a subset, and it's a little bit more strict. But the reality is, I think it's really important from a business to understand that we're not only protecting the consumers, but we're also protecting our brand from lawsuits. Because now we're not allowing any personally identifiable information to get out into the public of any of these consumers that we're capturing their data, so that we can then suggest things to them, whether or not it's an email or a like or a, you know, content. Because when somebody comes to our website, they may be only interested in skateboarding and BMX and have no care in the world for motocross, right? And we'd love to be able to provide them content, but we want to do it with their consent.
Yeah, it definitely becomes a balancing act both on the business and the content owner side as well as on the consumer side. How much do I want you to know about me so that you can market the right or provide me with the right kind of product for my particular tastes?
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I think as challenging as it is, all these landscape shifts and regulatory changes, I think it's extremely important. And having knowing that consumers have that capability now, I think it's empowering for them. And to your point, I think they need to take more action. If they are concerned about their privacy, they do need to remove themselves from those logs. And for us, I think it also helps because the ecosystem is playing on the same level.
I think that category for new jobs is big right now, is hiring someone to handle that, along with accessibility. I have colleagues that are focused on that, and also with multiculturalism. Those are the three topics that I hear now for the most hires is, you know, am I being ethnic enough, you know, and am I, is this accessible to everyone, and then also am I protecting consumer rights? Right, because if you ask anyone right now who's maybe not on staff at Facebook, they may have a very negative opinion of Facebook just because of everything that's happened, right? So you can really hurt your brand if you don't hit at this correctly.
Well, and it was, you know, Facebook was a platform that emerged in an era where there were no controls and there was no governance around it. And with, you know, all the emphasis and energy they built it out in a way that made Facebook make sense and make money. And nobody can blame them for that. But now it's kind of coming back around and pulling it back in. I think another thing that's going to be very interesting, but it will probably happen with regulation, is all of you who are wearing Apple Watches or biometric, you know, Fitbits or anything, I think when that information starts to get incorporated into particularly content delivery, I'm probably have a different heart rate and a different temperature potentially when I want to watch a horror. I don't watch horror, so I'm one of those. When I want to watch an action movie as opposed to a comedy movie. And at some point in time, it'd be interesting to think that that could be incorporated. But I don't think we're there yet. Yeah. So that's super future stuff. So flash around, we're almost out of time. Flash around, think 10 years into the future. What does this all look like?
Oh, gosh. Coming to me first.
Yes, because you looked at me directly.
Here's my hope for the entertainment industry. I think that the rise of direct-to-consumer SVOD services will demonstrably change how entertainment is made and marketed. I think green light process will change because they'll have better predictions of outcomes. I don't think, and I have a lot of good friends who are on the creative and production side, that we're at a state where a computer's going to spit out a script. I do think, though, that it can start to say, this time of year, this type of genre with these actors, with this director, this is what your install base of highest interest is. And then it'll be more kind of on the attitudinal side to get to the why and the how. But I would expect that we will continue to see, the proliferation of kind of direct-to-consumer efforts on the entertainment space, and I think it's going to be successful. I think being able now to have confidence in your bets more so than like, oh, I hope it does well. Oh, it didn't. Okay, we have three more bets left. I think people will be able to have more confidence in it. So I think for our industry, that's a good thing.
I think we're looking at a world that's completely censored. I mean, censorized. Devices, not. Not people not letting me say what I want, but censored. I think we're going to live in a world that's censored, and so all those inputs all the time will create a very curated experience. So you will have content experiences, your home, your environments will be curated to your needs because of those inputs. And I think the other thing that we should be paying more attention to is live streaming. Live streaming has all sorts of fascinating behaviors that are very different from the stuff we're talking about right now that are fascinating in terms of audience involvement in the storytelling of content. And so live is going to become a really interesting part of I think, the content world.
I mean, future? I mean, how many have seen WALL-E or Fifth Element or some of these like sort of like sci-fi fantasy concepts? I mean, the realities are, we were told we were going to have flying cars in 2020, right? What do we have? Electric cars. And the reality is that the biggest technology advancement right now is batteries. That's like the biggest thing in the world today is how good are our batteries. So from a content consumer standpoint, I think we're going to get there. I think it's a work in process. I think some of the challenges that we are approaching today, we have better technology to understand it. And I think the consumers having better controls and being able to control that. I'm a consumer that I don't want it to be tailored. I want the vanilla experience. So I'm the opposite of anybody else. I don't want them to suggest, horror films or drama films. I want to know what are the one star R-rated movies on Netflix. Why? Because they're terrible films and I think that they're interesting. Why did they get a one star? Right? And that piques my curiosity. But,
and we know that about you, actually. Yeah. We know that you like rotten movies.
I think everyone's going to hang out with you later.
So no, but I just think from a futuristic standpoint, I mean, where do we go from here, right? I mean, that some of the technologies in like AV, we saw that there's this clear glass that you can project images onto, and all of these things. It is going to be more experiential, and it is going to be cool, and there are going to be environments, but it's going to take money to get there. And I think the reality is how do we take these things and boil it down to a simplicity standpoint that either makes it available to the consumers or the consumers are going to come forward and pay money for it. Mm-hmm. So
we just have about a minute left. I'd like to ask if there's any questions from the audience. I think we've got one back there. Do we have a mic?
I do. Here we go.
Guy does everything around here. Here he comes.
Here I am. I was buttering bread.
Thank you, Guy.
Break.
This is a question for Chad, and I know we've talked about regulations and such, CCPA, GDPR. How has COPPA affected what you do?
It's a good question. All of our engagements are with adults via credit card on the Fandango side. So COPPA that's the validation for COPPA. It follows that guideline as a credit card transaction. So we treat those as adults.
What about Rotten Tomatoes?
Rotten Tomatoes, again, it's we follow COPPA guidelines as far as our email is concerned. Rotten Tomatoes does not have the transactional piece as well, but we are in compliance on COPPA with Rotten Tomatoes as well.
Anyone else?
Okay, I think that's it.
Thank you to the panel.
Thank you, Nona. Thank you, panel. Smart engagements.